Coming up next, a special edition of Off the Wall, recorded in Amsterdam in August of 2013. That will be followed by some 20th century music all about Dutch stereotypes like wooden shoes, tulips, and windmills. This is Emmanuel Goldstein. Welcome to Off the Wall.
Thank you.
So, Kyle, here we are in Amsterdam. Isn't this rather amazing?
Yes, it's really amazing.
Well, we are back from Ohm, Observe, Hack, Make. That's what it stood for. That was the week-long hacker camp that we attended. Camped out for a full week, 7 nights, because we arrived early to help set up and stayed a little late. And now we're back in Amsterdam, just kind of hanging out, getting our stuff together while we figure out where to go next. But maybe now it's a good time to sort of reflect back on what this was like for both of us.
I think it was really fun. It was a good a chance to get out and camp and meet other people.
Mm-hmm.
And hear what's going on, talk about some of the things. There was a really good radio installation at the event.
Ohm Roop is what they called it. That was, I think it's a play on some kind of radio station here in the Netherlands. So, yeah, we did some shows there. In fact, maybe we will air some of those on this station or maybe another station. Maybe we already have aired them. I don't know. We did radio. That's all I do know.
Yeah, there were a couple, at least one or two programs that we did covering some of the results from the Bradley Manning verdict. And
it's funny because the Bradley Manning verdict, or I guess the judge's ruling, came in literally the minute that the radio station went on the air, the day before Ohm officially began. I think maybe we were speaking to Brenner, who ran the radio station, and we got the news the day before that the verdict was going to be handed down at, I believe, 7 p.m. Their time, 2 p.m. our time, or 1 p.m. our time, something like that. We told him what time that was going to be happening. I think maybe they kind of paced the starting of the radio station to that particular moment, because when that happened, that's when we found ourselves on the air. And there I was on my computer monitoring news sites and Twitter, and basically saying, okay, here's what we know so far. And it was really, it was kind of cool, but also kind of disturbing seeing how things went. And I'm sure by the time this airs, the sentencing part will be finished as well.
Yeah, it was really amazing. I don't know. The event was the largest, I think, as far as the terrain's concerned, that I've been to for an event like that. And there were lots of individual villages of all kinds.
Yeah, there really were. And some of them were really neat. Well, of course, we had the 2600 village. There were some issues with that. Because, well, we decided to have our village in the forest, and then it wasn't until a couple of days after the event began that they told us that we weren't allowed to be in the forest because of some stupid regulation. So we had to move and move into the field, which meant that we basically got woken up by the sun every day when the sun came up, which is the whole point of being in the woods. So that, combined with a couple other things, meant the 2600 village didn't really kick off like it should have. But we kind of made it a mobile village. We wandered around talking to people, and we had a great meeting in the media cafe, which was a nice addition to the camps, where media people could sort of hang out and do filming and do other gatherings. And we just basically talked about 2600 and hope and things like that. So that was kind of nice. Other villages, though, of course, the Italian embassy was there with their grappa and their pasta. There was a Spanish village, which was really nice. We had some ham there. They basically, everybody was giving us food, which was really kind of cool. We went to Milloway's, which is a tradition at these camps from a bunch of people that just kind of make food and have beer and bring people together and things like that. A lot of independent sources for this kind of thing, and I thought that was really a nice touch. So many villages, so many countries represented.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think it had a very, like, a broad international feel. Yeah. it's been a whirlwind just to have been camping for so long at an event like that. And, yeah, we were just really getting used to the surviving like that. it's pretty incredibly warm right now at this time. I don't know. I've experienced no summer like this in Holland.
I've experienced no summer like this on Earth.
As you might remember, Har was like a bit more tree covered as far as where the recreation site
mm-hmm.
was.
Yes, yes, exactly. And so was the CCC camp.
Yes.
And this was in basically, I guess a former farm field or something, so there were really very few trees. That's why we gravitated towards the trees in the first place, because we recognized the value of them.
Yeah, and I don't know, the event was really well put together logistically. They had sort of pretty much handled most every convenience, and... Then, like, I think there were some problems with, like, providing alternatives and, like, options for people. But what was really cool is seeing camaraderie and people get together and just sort of create their own communities. And a lot of people brought resources and their own kind of flair to their camps.
Here's how I look at it. Yeah, there was adversity, there was controversy, there were hardships to overcome, and we can talk for a long time about that. I don't really see the point, to be honest, because this is sort of, to me, a parallel to people coming to our country, coming to the United States and saying, well, there's this problem, that problem, and this is why I can't do it. And I just think, you know, even if there's something that you don't agree with or something that you think was done improperly, you're better off being there, talking to the people, conversing with your friends, because they are your friends, and basically having your presence felt rather than your absence being felt. And that's why I always encourage people, despite whatever they might say, as far as reasons they had for not going, that going was always better than not going. And I say the same thing to people that debate going to the States for one conference or another, particularly our HOPE conferences. And we talk to people about this quite a bit, you know, people in Europe who say that they don't want to be fingerprinted, they don't want to have their pictures taken, they don't want to be sent to Guantanamo Bay, which doesn't really happen. It's important that we talk this out, but that you also realize that if you don't even participate, then the people that don't want you there have won without having to do a thing, because you've done all the work for them. And that's something we had that conversation at the meeting that we held, and a number of other times as well, as we walked around talking to people. And I think that's an important dialogue that needs to be had.
Yeah, definitely. I really felt personally that it's really inspiring to catch up with friends that you've made at these events and realize that we... I don't know, just to see how many had been inspired by their experience. A lot of them maybe I met, and they were also like new to the conference and these kinds of camps themselves, and now they've gone on to like start their own like spaces and get involved volunteer wise, and that's what keeps them going, keeps fresh like perspectives, fresh ideas and stuff coming through the community.
There are people we met at previous conferences and camps that were new, just there for the first time, and we just started conversations with them. And yeah, as Kyle says, now they're running their own hackerspaces, they're organizing things, they're helping with logistics and various other things like that. And that is what drives these events, the volunteer spirit, the people just basically getting started for the first time. And that, in turn, turns into inspiration for more people getting involved. And without that, you don't have anything, because you can have the best organization in the world, but without all those people there to support it and to evolve it into different things, what you have at best is something predictable and corporate. And what you have when you have literally hundreds of people organizing and building and making it better, making it unique, and overcoming obstacles, that's when you have a hacker event. That's when you have something that no one else can really do.
Yeah. I don't know. It's kind of sad to see it have, like, passed so quickly. It was really quite a long event, and lots to do, lots to talk about. I'm sure we're going to tell some more stories.
It passed quickly, yeah, I'll say that. I mean, we were in a tent for 7 days, and we got out of the tent, too, but it was just, I'd never done anything quite like that before, such a long period of time. And after a while, just you're on automatic pilot. Well, first of all, Kyle and I actually rode our bikes. We rented bikes and rode them down from Amsterdam
yes.
all the way to where the campsite was. And even Dutch people are impressed by that, especially when we tell them that we had a fixed gear. We use fixed gear bikes. And, you know, there's some contention as to what the right terminology is for that, single speed, fixed gear. All I can say is, you know, the place we rented the bikes from, they said it was fixed gear, so that's what we're calling it. It's basically you have one gear and you brake by hitting the pedal backwards, okay? So that's what we rode. Each of us had a bike like that, and we rode it for, I'd say, probably about 4.5 hours all the way down there. It's supposed to only take 3 hours, so obviously when you have that kind of a bike, it takes longer. But, you know, I did that on virtually no sleep for after 3 days of virtually no sleep, and I'll tell you why. We came to this country, I think it was on a Thursday, and we wound up going to the campsite on Sunday, went there to stay. And in all those periods of time, we were staying at a friend's house who lived right next to a church tower, and every half hour that church tower would toll, and on the hour it would toll the hours. So you would know when it was 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and this went on overnight too. Like in the States, church towers sometimes shut down at night because they realize that it can drive people insane. I'm one of the people that drove insane because what happens is you're trying to get to sleep, and you want to get to sleep before the bell tolls again, and you certainly want to get to sleep before you hear the bell tell you what time it is. You know, imagine like a voice in your room that keeps announcing the time every half hour. It would drive you insane. Some people can fall asleep immediately. I have trouble even when I'm tired. And so what that meant was I never got more than 2 or 3 hours sleep in that particular situation. And then, on top of that, to have to ride a bike all the way from Amsterdam to this campsite, that was a real test of my abilities. And I'm happy to say that I passed the test. I made it there. I ached all over. And then I got to sleep on the ground because we didn't have an air mattress, just solid on the ground inside a tent for the next 7 days. And now we're back in Amsterdam, and we're in a place where we can actually be a bit more comfortable, but that's why we sound kind of tired, because we've been through so much. I mean, Kyle, you too. You've been through quite a bit. I'm impressed by your stamina.
Oh, thanks. I don't know. It's definitely rustic to be sleeping on just a flat terrain, but I think it was a worthy adventure, and we were off to see some more places, and it's just as soon as we're together, repacked, and sort of rest it up, we'll embark.
It takes some time. It really does. It takes time to just regather yourself. And right now we're on a balcony at another friend's place in the middle of the city. It's late at night. You might even hear some people walking around down in the alley. Sometimes they get quite loud. We've done some relaxing things. We just saw a movie at this place called The Eye, which is across a canal from Central Station here in Amsterdam.
Isn't that amazing?
Didn't even know that was there. You found this place. Obviously, everybody in Amsterdam knows about it, but I didn't know about it, and we wouldn't have checked it out, I don't think.
Yeah, it's this new building that was built on a campus from a corporate tenant that moved. So they had this big site and this kind of arts cultural center. Actually, it's a film museum and archive was built, and it's really gorgeous architecture.
Yeah, you can't bring popcorn into the movie, but you can bring a bottle of wine.
Yeah.
And a Mars bar. That's what we... you can have sweet things. You can't have salty things. I'm not sure... someone was explaining this to us, that there's a difference between artsy film places and regular film places, and the regular ones, yeah, you can have popcorn. The artsy ones, you can have chocolate or something like that. But, yeah, a full bottle of wine we consumed seeing the film, which was kind of a different perspective for me. And it was just also going to a different part of town. You know, instead of taking trams or walking around, we took a ferry across to the northern part of Amsterdam.
Yes, Amsterdam Noord. We actually bicycled through there. And
did we? Is that how we got to the campsite? We went to the... Because the campsite was north of the city, right?
Yes, yes, it was. It wasn't that far north. It was on a farm near their town of Alkmaar, I believe was the name.
Yes.
Yeah, and amazing. It seems like far away at this point. But
well, yeah, it was. And when we bicycled down there, it was also kind of magical because we were basically, they have bicycle paths all throughout this entire country, and it's very flat, so you don't really ever get tired cycling. You see people well into their 70s cycling, you know, throughout the countryside and the city.
I will say it's different cycling in Amsterdam.
Very different from what we're used to in the States. You can get by on a fixed gear bike, no problem. And we just were out there in the countryside, through farm fields and meadows and things like that, for miles and miles. And of course, after several hours went by, we were supposed to be there. I had no idea where we were. We were going by way of your BlackBerry. It was telling us what roads to take, what paths to take. You know, these paths have been there forever. Some of them have a road attached to them. Many of them don't. And we just kept cycling and cycling, passing wind turbines, passing farms, passing all sorts of things. And it seemed like it was going on forever. And I guess it was. And after a while, we just kind of arrived. But we were so tired and achy at that point.
Yeah, definitely. It was nice though. I was sneezing a bit. And
well, you forgot to take your hay fever medication.
Yeah,
you should have done.
Yeah.
And then after a while, a couple of days into the camp, I decided I want to take a ride, and I rode all the way over to Alkmaar. That was interesting. You know, I just kept riding down these long, long roads, and seeing other local people riding by. And just getting further and further away from the camp and wondering, okay, am I going to find my way back? Because I don't really know how to get back. I'm just trying to keep track of all the, reference points. And I found my way back. It wasn't easy, but I did it. And that was a bit of an adventure. But we had so many others. And we basically talked to so many people, met a lot of listeners, a lot of readers, a lot of potential Hope attendees. And realized just how big and expansive the hacker world is. And then coming back here and just kind of chilling with people from the area. Some Americans were here for a couple of days. We chose to stay longer before we head off to another point. Do you want to talk about where we might be heading?
I think we're going to a little bit to the east and to the south.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to go around towards Italy, and I think we're going to go via Croatia. That was an idea.
That was an idea.
Which is a place we'd been.
Right, right. We have been to Croatia.
But I'm really interested in the first leg. It's, I think, Luxembourg.
Luxembourg is definitely, it can be on the way, even though people here don't seem to ever go to Luxembourg. I've been there once, and it's a very interesting place, small country, but big compared to places like Liechtenstein. Very mountainous, from what I remember, and it's part of, a network of countries. It's called Benelux, Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, and there's some kind of train deal that goes with that. So that could be a potential first leg. We haven't decided yet exactly what we're doing. Nobody can understand the way we travel because we just do it differently than most people. We don't make reservations well in advance. We don't really know what we're doing until we decide to do it. And that really opens us up to a lot of new things. Like, I remember we were in England last year, and someone said, hey, you know, we have a hackerspace in Manchester, come visit us. And we said, okay, you know what, we can do that. It's sort of where we are, where we're heading. We could take a pit stop along the way and check out this place. And by leaving yourself open, if something like that comes up, you can say, okay, let's divert a little bit and check out this place, meet some local people. Nothing better than hanging out with local people and doing local things. Yesterday we rode in the canals for hours and hours.
Isn't that neat?
That was awesome. We just were with a whole bunch of Dutch people and just riding around, driving through the canals. I've never done that before. And you see a whole different way of life. You see people who live in these houseboats. You see other boaters as well. You see tourists on the street looking at you, taking pictures. And I've been here so many times, I've never done that.
Yeah, me, I mean, when a Dutch person, I guess, someone from Amsterdam says to, maybe come for a boat ride, I think you take them up on it. It was really a treat.
Absolutely.
To experience their, like, the passageways. I never realized the likeness to, like, automobiles, all the traffic rules and things like that. But
that's
it
right.
Makes perfect sense to me as someone who travels or, you know, likes transportation and stuff.
Yeah, there are rules. When you go into bridges, like, only one boat can go at a time. They're going the other direction. You can't go while they're going.
Right.
Things like that. But, you know, it's got to be coordinated somehow. And they do have a system, like they have for everything else. There is a system.
Absolutely. You can even tie up under the bridges sometimes.
It started raining. So what happens when you're on a boat that doesn't have a top and it's raining? Well, you just pull in underneath a bridge, and they have these, like, little, what do you call those things that you lasso the rope to?
Cleats,
okay. And you just tie up there, and you hang out underneath the bridge until the rain goes by. And you can stick up to 8 boats per bridge, apparently.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. We stopped just for a minute,
and then what?
The rain passed.
Yeah, what else? You noticed a truck spraying water onto one of the bridges, and they explained this whole system to you as to how they keep what?
Yeah, oh my gosh, E, this is amazing. It's basically the bridge, they were never able to, like, forge it or, like, install it when it was a certain temperature, so it wouldn't expand, if they let it expand fully, it won't open, so they have to cool it, and they use this sometimes by sprinklers, and in this case, when they really need to, I guess, because the temperature in this particular time of the year, the trucks come by and dump, like, a set allotment of gallons for cooling to allow the bridge to be cool enough to open.
Wow. And, yeah, we were underneath one of the bridges, and we saw the water pouring down, I guess, which is what it's supposed to do.
It's a routine activity.
But some bridges do it by themselves?
Yeah, they install sprinkler systems or some kind of liquid cooling to keep the bridge cool. I don't think this bridge had that feature, or they needed to saturate it with these deliveries. It was pretty odd to see this truck just before we went under it. Actually, I thought it was going to drip on us, but. Yeah, I guess it's because of the era that the bridge was manufactured in.
Which is like, what, the 1700s or something? I mean, things here are so old.
Yeah, that's a real interesting attribute of being in Europe at any time, in any place. And it's been a really fun time here in Holland.
It's just Amsterdam, really. It's just really been here in the campsite.
Yeah, it's been a great first week or two here.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited for some of the ideas we have going into that. What do you see?
I see a white cat down the alley walking. See that?
Right.
There's cats all over the place here. In fact, this is something interesting too, because there's a Spanish place I like to go to around here, atop this place that you could just get a beer or have food or something like that. But I described it to Kyle as a place with a cat. And, of course, we walked down there. I hadn't been here in a couple of years, and there's the cat in the window just sort of sleeping. And, you know, in many countries, you can't have a cat in a restaurant. Here, it's a common thing. If, you know, you don't want mice or rats, you have a cat, and a cat is very public, very social, comes up to the people and says hi and greets them, and you just sort of see them. They're very, very calm. They know their place here, you know, which is basically running the place. People come up to them, and they're just very very calm and very very friendly.
Yeah, I like to see it. I didn't really notice it until you pointed it out.
Yeah, and they're everywhere around here. Every place seems to have one. But there's other little things, too, like, you know, getting our clothes washed at the local laundry and just, like, handing it to a guy who hands it back to you a few hours later. No IDs or anything like that. He just knows your face. And just little moments like that, little conversations with local shopkeepers or just various other people or tourists coming up to you asking you questions because they think you know where things are and doing your best to help them. things like that, you know, it's magic coming to a place like this. It's as magical as it was when I came here the first time. It's changed, you know, things have changed quite a bit in various ways. The EU didn't exist when I first came here. There seem to be more rules in place, and other things, though, haven't changed. The culture, the history, the general mood seems to be about the same. But as far as the rest of the world goes, I think it's still the place to go to sort of let loose a little bit and not worry about things. People seem very laid back and not obsessed as we are back home. It is, though, kind of weird to see tourists going around, you know, buying hash and pot and going to the red light district and all that kind of thing, because the people here, for the most part, just sort of look back with amusement and watch all that. They don't really participate in that kind of thing themselves, and I think that sort of adds to the charm of it, is that all this is going on right in their backyards, literally, and they just kind of, you know, they kind of tolerate that and just sort of watch it, and I guess we kind of do the same thing back home in, to some degree when people from all over the world come and stare at our buildings and things like that.
Yeah, definitely. That's a that tolerance is huge, I would say.
Yeah.
But it's really pleasant, as you said. I don't know. I enjoy kind of going, doing like regular things, shopping, just doing normal Dutch things.
Well, you went to the cheese shop the other day, and you really knew your way around the cheese shop.
Yeah, it was fun. I was just doing the same thing that, like, you do. And, you know, it helps to have a snack when you're traveling.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be moving lots of times and pack some stuff. So having a bit of, like, a snack for the train ride or anything is really helpful. So I like to pick up a couple things that keep for a little while.
And not a fast food thing. Not just going to, you know, some fast food establishment and getting something there. What Kyle's talking about is basically getting bread, getting cheese, getting crackers, getting whatever, and just sort of assembling things yourself and just being creative. And first of all, you save a ton of money, but you also get an actual taste, literally, of what it's like locally, you know, and I think that's far more valuable.
Yeah. I got a really large piece of brie for, like, under €2,
yeah,
which translates to like around $3 or $4.
Yeah, more like, I think like $2.50 or something. It's
maybe
pretty good.
Less.
Yeah, no, that was a good deal.
That's a good price for a wedge.
Yeah, but you know there are other things that don't quite work out. We just had a pizza from downstairs, and you know the guy was friendly enough. It turned out he was from Egypt. We were talking to him for quite some time.
Yeah,
but I gotta say the pizza was not up to the standards that I'm used to, and of course the standards that anyone from New York would be used to, or even anyone from the States. I don't know why they can't make good pizza here, but there's other things. There's Stroopwafel, for instance. Do you want to describe what those are?
Stroopwafel.
Okay, you can say it better than me, but can you describe it better than me?
No, I just like saying it.
Uh-huh.
There are these, just as it says, waffle, like round waffles, and it's a snack, so you can get these discs that have like a cake kind of material, and it sandwiches like a caramel filling.
It looks like a waffle. It looks like a little mini waffle.
Yeah, and they're really, really tasty and good snacks.
Yeah.
So I like to get those. I don't know. I got different ideas of things because I came during the winter one time when people are often giving gifts out, and I found that these are available everywhere. You can get them in the States, too. And it's a really, really good snack.
Yes, yeah.
They also have mini ones that are, like, the size of 50-cent pieces.
Well, as you can hear, some tourists are grazing in our alleyway right now, walking down, looking at the sights. This goes on pretty much all night long, and just like everything else, people have to tolerate what goes on outside their windows. It's the United States is a very unique city, a very unique place in the world today. But it's only one place, and that's why we want to move on and go to other places and experience other things and kind of share that with the people who are back home in whatever way we can. So, yeah, you know, we're thinking about Luxembourg. Maybe we'll sleep on it and decide if we want to add to that or go in other directions. But that's the freedom of just being able to travel and to your heart's content.
Yeah, it's one of those things I think that has come about with technology and like globalization and stuff. And as individuals, it's worthwhile if you can to partake in, because it's structurally, like, you know, it's a mental shift to like use it to broaden your perspective, and it's not that expensive, I guess. It's not unavailable. You just have to make time. You have to plan. It's just like any other traveling. Like, you commute to work or do some other activity in your region, and you always bring something back, and you're amazed at how many other people might be from where you're from, and how much understanding there is, even when you don't necessarily speak the same language. And there's all kinds of tools as well that allow us to communicate and be understood much better. So, yeah, I've learned some really cool things at the camp, and just getting back into that mindset of traveling and being on your feet and living kind of a little bit nomadically. It's tough. Gosh, but that camping was a reminder. Brings you back to what you might imagine is like more rustic times.
Well, you got to be open to this kind of thing, and I think this also is a good kickoff for going other places, because you're not always going to get the comforts of home, you know, and it's going to be different. It's going to be rough sometimes, but ultimately it'll be very valuable. It'll pay off in so many other ways, just in what you get out of it, the conversations you have, the experiences that you never would have had were you not open to this. And yeah, you can go from like hotel to hotel and live in comfort and things like that, but then you're not getting that. You're also spending a lot more money too, for that matter. But if you don't mind roughing it a bit and don't mind being flexible.
Demanding.
What, being demanding?
Well, you have to demand the right things.
No, that's what you don't do. You don't be demanding.
Yeah, exactly.
No, you don't want to be demanding. And, basically, somebody brings you some weird food that you've never had before, you try it out, you know? You basically open yourself up to a different culture. And Americans have this tendency of saying, no, I have to have it this way, no other way. And it's just, what do you really gain from that in the end? It's just basically
stubborn.
It's a bad image to put forward, I think.
Stubborn and sort of, closed. Closed-minded. I like to absorb the kind of local mood and, I don't know, really create understanding and be gracious.
Yes.
As you're a guest in the world.
And you can communicate that without knowing any words from any other language. It's a lot of things are gestures and smiles and things like that. And I think it's really good to be able to master that. And that gives you strength to move on to the next place.
Yeah, people will take care of you if you navigate it. But yeah, it's pretty exciting.
It is. We don't really sound that excited right now because we're exhausted. We've been running around all day long. So I think maybe we should just crash for a little bit. Maybe we'll think of some other things to say in the morning when we're more alert, and then we can plan where we're going to go next and talk about that a bit. What do you think?
Absolutely.
All right. We'll be back.
across the sea in Holland, in the land of wooden shoes. There's a story nearly everyone knows. You may never be in Holland, so I know you will excuse if here and now I tell you how it goes. There's a little Dutch mill on a little Dutch hill, where the little Dutch stars shine bright. Now a little Dutch boy and his little Dutch girl fell in love by the mill one night. Up above the Dutch moon made the scene complete. They both had so much moon that it was a real Dutch treat. So the little Dutch boy and the little Dutch girl bought the little Dutch mill on the little Dutch hill, and they've added the touch of a little Dutch family. Dutch moon made the scene complete. They both had so much moon that it really was the real Dutch tree. So the little Dutch boy and the little Dutch girl bought the Dutch mill on the Dutch hill. They added the touch of family.
Heaven in a pair of wooden shoes. In an old Dutch garden where the tulips grow, that's where I first whispered that I love you so. My heart was blue till I gave it to an angel in a pair of wooden shoes. Then one sad day, when summer meets September, I sailed away from a thrill I will remember. In an old Dutch garden by an old Dutch mill, every day I pray that you are waiting still. My heart will yearn until I return to heaven in a pair of wooden shoes.
Dutchman's not the kind of man to keep his thumb jammed in the dam that holds his dreams in. But that's a secret only Margaret knows. When Amsterdam is golden in the morning, Margaret brings him breakfast. She believes him. He thinks the tulips bloom beneath the snows. He's mad as he can be, but Margaret only sees that sometimes. Sometimes she sees our unborn children in his eyes. Let us go to the banks of the ocean, where the walls rise above the Zuider Zee. Long ago, I used to be a young man, and dear Margaret remembers that plea. The Dutchman still wears wooden shoes, his cap and coat are patched with love that Margaret sewed in. Sometimes he thinks he's still in Rotterdam. He watches tugboats down canals and calls out to them when he thinks he knows the captain. Till Margaret comes to take him home again. Through unforgiving streets that trip him, though she holds his arm. Sometimes he thinks that he's alone and calls her name. Let us go to the banks of the ocean, where the walls rise above the Zuider Zee. Long ago, I used to be a young man, and dear Margaret remembers that plea. Windmills swirl the wintering. She winds his muffler tighter. They sit in the kitchen. And the tea with whiskey keeps away the dew. He sees her for a moment, calls her name. She makes his bed up, humming some old love song. She learned it when the tune was very new. He hums a line or two. They hum together in the night. The Dutchman falls asleep, and Margaret blows the candle out. Let us go to the banks of the ocean, where the walls rise above the Zuider Zee. Long ago, I used to be a young man, and dear Margaret remembers that plea. Let us go to the banks of the ocean, where the walls rise above the Zuider Zee. Long ago, I used to be a young man, and dear Margaret remembers that.